I'm David Lazarus from the Los Angeles Times, sitting in for Tess Viglin, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of August 31st, 2012. We're midway through the political convention season, and if you're like me, you're already sick of all the posturing and grandstanding. But theatrics aside, there are a whole bunch of personal finance issues on the table, and they couldn't have a greater impact on your wallet. Are voters getting the straight dope?
I believe that there has been a massive amount of misrepresentation going on. I would say almost a lack of honesty.
On today's show, we'll cut through the political rhetoric and look at what's really at stake on a variety of fronts. Healthcare, Medicare, student loans. We'll even explore the issue of government playing a role in your eating habits.
If there were a vaccine that would prevent you from wanting to go into McDonald's or wanting to drink 32 ounces of sugary beverages, I bet a lot of the people who would otherwise consume those beverages would line up to get a vaccine like that.
Right here on Marketplace Money from APM.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Here we are, smack dab in the middle of the convention season. Cue the balloons. The Republicans had their turn last week. The Democrats come next. Okay, there are plenty of personal finance issues being aired by the two guys who want to be president. But what are the issues voters are most interested in? Marketplace's David Gura recently traveled through both states hosting this year's conventions as part of our coverage of how all the tub-thumping plays out where it really matters, the economy. David's back from his road trip. Hey, David.
Hey, David.
All right, so let's start with Florida. Where'd you go?
So the powers that be dispatched me to the I-4 corridor. This is the area that goes from Daytona Beach down through Orlando all the way to Tampa, where the RNC was being held. And we picked this place because there is a high concentration of undecided voters along that highway. And people describe it to me as the belt sort of between the more conservative northern part of the state and the more liberal southern part of the state. This has now become sort of the key that presidential candidates know they need to win the state of Florida. So that's why they sent me there.
An area just rampant with political indecision. So what stood out to you?
Well, the heat, first of all. No, seriously, it was the housing crisis and the effects of the housing crisis and how they're still playing out there. And there are still for sale signs and foreclosure signs everywhere you look. Just the degree to which people are talking about it. The first person I talked to when I got to Florida was a woman named Gina Silvestri. She's an attorney. And the first thing I asked her was, what kind of law do you practice?
I have always handled real estate law, bankruptcy law, and family law, because ironically, they're all interrelated to one extent or another.
Okay, that's interesting, I thought. She says a lot of these things have become even more interrelated since the housing crisis. You've got a lot of people who are still struggling to make ends meet, and they're considering foreclosures and bankruptcy. And all of that, she told me, has led to this sort of breakdown of the family and higher filings of divorces she's seen.
So it's no longer love will keep us together.
Exactly.
Whole other song suddenly. Okay, so you split Florida, you head over to North Carolina, and what do you find there?
I wasn't following a geographic trajectory there. I was looking at North Carolina through this lens of a state that had a lot of traditional manufacturing, a lot of furniture making, textiles, and has been forced, in a way, to make a transition to high-tech, biotech, nanotech, something new. And I got the best sense of how that transition was happening at community colleges. I went to Forsyth Technical Community College. That's in Winston-Salem. And I talked to Jennifer Webb. Now, she's married, she's got teenage kids, and she's studying to be a nurse. And I asked her how things have been in North Carolina.
You can definitely tell that there is something going on when you see, I think, so many older students going back to school. That reflects on the economy and what's going on here in this area.
And what she's talking about there, I heard time and time again, not just at these community colleges, but in the communities I visited, that everyone talked about how in the last couple of years, either they or people they know have been given an opportunity. That's how they described it. And of course, you read between the lines there. The opportunity is they've been laid off, or they saw the writing on the wall, they were going to be laid off. And that was a chance for them to go back to school, to get new skills, to maybe think about where they might be working in a couple of weeks, in a couple of months, in a couple of years even. And I was just amazed at the extent to which community colleges in North Carolina, there are more than 50 of them across the state, have really dealt with this in a very nimble way. They're working with companies that are hiring to make sure the skills that they're teaching students will be useful, that they'll lead to jobs. And I was just amazed at how enrollment has gone up and the age of students at those schools has gone up as well.
So people in North Carolina are concerned about jobs and their future in the job market. What else is on their mind?
What I heard from a lot of people were questions about healthcare and retirement. I stopped in Lenoir, North Carolina. That's a town in the western part of the state. And I talked to Yvonne Miller. She retired to North Carolina from Michigan, and she works in a bookstore downtown part-time.
I was on the fence 2 weeks ago. Couldn't make my mind up. I have now. Speaking as a senior citizen, I would sincerely like them to clarify Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. I want my grandchildren, I have a great-grandchild too, I want to know they're going to be safe.
So this would have been like a week after Mitt Romney picked Congressman Paul Ryan to be his running mate. And as you know, that sort of made these issues, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, much more central to this election. And I think that what Miller's talking about there, clarifying what's going to happen to these programs, what might happen to these programs, is going to be something we hear a lot about this week at the DNC and indeed all the way up to the election.
So, David, it sounds like voters are very concerned about meat and potatoes, pocketbook issues. Do they also have a sense of which party they think has a better formula to solve these problems?
That would be hard to say. I was surprised at how many voters told me that, you know, these 2.5 months out, they still haven't decided which party they like better, which party they think has a more clearer plan, and who they're going to vote for in November.
In other words, they're going to take it right down to the wire.
Absolutely.
Road warrior David Gurr is back from 2 reporting trips to Florida and North Carolina ahead of both the national party conventions. David Gurr, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
As Marketplace's David Gurra noted, healthcare is one of the biggest issues on voters' minds this election. And healthcare means the Affordable Care Act and Medicare. And, of course, Medicare is getting a lot of attention this convention season because it's the one thing that both President Obama and Governor Romney want to talk about all the time.
Because I know the Democrats are going to be showing videos of, old people being thrown off cliffs and so forth. But don't forget who it was that cut Medicare by $500 billion.
I've proposed reforms that will save Medicare money by getting rid of wasteful spending in the healthcare system. Reforms that will not touch your Medicare benefits, not by a dime. Now, Mr. Romney and his running mate have a very different plan.
Paul Ryan and I have talked about is saving Medicare, is providing people greater choice in Medicare, making sure it's there for current seniors. No changes, by the way, for current seniors or those nearing retirement.
The Romney-Ryan plan, of course, involves the use of vouchers. That's an approach that the Republican Party once rejected and has now come to embrace. Henry J. Aaron helped write the Medicare voucher program, now championed by Republicans. He's an economist and noted healthcare expert at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, throughout this whole debate, it's just so wonky. There's just so many big numbers involved. There's so many moving parts. How is the typical American, the typical voter, supposed to make an informed decision about Medicare reform?
I think they have to pay very close attention. And the reason I say that is I believe that there has been a massive amount of misrepresentation going on. I would say almost a lack of honesty about exactly what the plan being put forward by Mr. Romney and Mr. Ryan would entail. What isn't acknowledged is that if the savings and the additional revenues that would flow into Medicare as a result of health care reform were repealed, as Mr. Romney has pledged to do, the date of insolvency of the Medicare Hospital Insurance Trust Fund would move up from 2024 to 2016, forward 8 years by their proposal, and we have not seen any suggestion of how equivalent savings could be achieved in some other way.
Let's talk a little bit about one of the centerpieces of, I guess, what we could call the Ryan Romney plan, and that is the idea of vouchers. In other words, people who are eligible for Medicare, whether they are a senior or a disabled person, would receive a set amount of money. They could use that money to buy into Medicare, or they could buy a similar plan from a private insurer. Will that system work?
The idea that we need to drastically overhaul the system in order to provide Medicare beneficiaries a lot of choice is just dead wrong. It's a misrepresentation of the facts. The choice now exists. The real question is, in the event that healthcare spending rises faster than targets, who bears the cost of that increase? And under the Ryan plan, if healthcare spending continues to rise at historical rates, if the various reforms that have been enacted don't work as they are, as we hope and many of us expect they will work, then the out-of-pocket expenses for Medicare beneficiaries go up.
Now, you were an early proponent of vouchers, what you called at the time premium support, and yet you've had a change of heart.
I have had a change of heart. What the military calls the facts on the ground have changed radically. We have enacted overall health care reform, and the nation has a real job now to implement that reform and make it work. Insurers have a very strong temptation to compete on the basis of trying to enroll the least expensive customers. That's a very easy population to deal with compared to the Medicare population.
I just want to zero in on that one point, and that's the idea that private insurers might offer plans that are a little cheaper than Medicare, perhaps less comprehensive, thus attracting healthier people, meaning that the sicker population would go into the traditional Medicare plan. And if I understand correctly, that would drive Medicare rates up even higher.
That's right. You staff up in a way that provides a less than optimal service for the most costly medical conditions. But you take care very nicely of the diseases of the well, such as offering a sports medicine benefit to potential clients.
And yet Medicare as we know it is still very troubled. And according to the people who run Medicare, the program is looking at a roughly $30 trillion shortfall over the next 75 years.
Well, let's try and put that in some context. The Affordable Care Act closed two-thirds of the long-term gap that was projected in Medicare hospital insurance. The remainder of Medicare is fully financed. It's financed by a combination of premiums and by general revenues, which Congress has said will be available in amounts sufficient to cover existing benefits. Now, we have to acknowledge that we spend an awful lot on health care, more than any other country does by a wide margin. We're not as efficient as we should be. And we have a health care system problem, so we need to address that. But supplemental medical insurance, doctor's bills, the drug part of coverage, those are fully paid for under current law, and there is no gap in financial coverage there.
Henry J. Aaron is an economist and healthcare expert at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Aaron, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, we know healthcare is a hot-button issue for listeners of this show, and we're pretty certain you've got something to say. So spill it. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and join the conversation. More than one in three adults in America is considered obese, and the obesity epidemic has contributed to a steady increase in healthcare costs. We're constantly being told to eat right and get some exercise, but that doesn't seem to be cutting it, does it? Some say we need to put our money where our mouths are and use financial incentives to change people's eating habits. Commentator and Dr. Mitchell Katz says it's time to serve up a tax on junk food.
The United States is suffering from an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. These two related epidemics are shortening our lifespan and causing tremendous suffering and economic loss. The solution is for all of us to eat a better diet, one that's high in fruits and vegetables, whole grains and fiber, and low on concentrated sweets and saturated fats. We also need to get more exercise. The problem is that it's hard for people to consistently follow these recommendations. One reason is our society has produced perverse economic incentives. Over time, the cost of sugar-sweetened beverages has gotten less expensive compared to the costs of more healthful choices like milk. In other words, our economic system makes the logical choice a big glass of soda instead of a big glass of milk. Here is where there's tremendous value in instituting a surcharge or tax on junk food and sugary drinks. By increasing the cost, we make it easier for people to make the more healthful choice. The tax money can be used to increase awareness about the harm of junk food and fund projects that encourage better choices. Copying a successful tactic of anti-tobacco crusaders, the funds could also be used to counter the lavish advertising of soda and junk food by marketing alternatives like apples or ordinary tap water. A common criticism of the surcharge is that it alone will not change obesity and diabetes rates. This is probably true. It's going to take many different interventions. We should eliminate farm subsidies for corn production, which makes the corn syrup and sweetened beverages so cheap. We need to increase the number of farmers' markets. We need to provide zoning incentives to place supermarkets in low-income neighborhoods so people can buy good food at an affordable price. Improving school lunches and reinstituting physical education will also help. No one strategy will end the twin epidemics of obesity and diabetes, but a surcharge on junk food is one promising strategy to make it easier for people to make the healthy choice.
Dr. Mitchell Katz is director of the Los Angeles County Department of Health Services. So, should the government be in the business of telling people what they can and can't eat? And, nanny state alert, is it even possible to legislate healthy behavior? Let's turn to Dr. David Ash. He's executive director of the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics. He's also a physician at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. Dr. Ash, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
All right, I want to play a little clip for you. Check this out. What jumps out at me there, Dr. Ash, is the fact that McDonald's isn't selling Big Macs, isn't selling French fries. What they're selling is a lifestyle choice.
Yeah. And, you know, it's an apparently very compelling lifestyle choice. This is an omnipresent campaign. And, you know, there are elements of McDonald's food and the other kinds of foods that are like McDonald's food that are extremely attractive to consumers and perhaps not surprisingly, there's an enormous amount of marketing muscle right behind that.
When we talk about what, if anything, should be done about fast food, junk food, sugary beverages, a lot of people immediately raise their hands and say, ooh, personal responsibility. It's not about regulating this stuff. It's not about telling consumers what they can and can't have. It's about people making their own choices. What's the answer to that?
I think that's a great question. It hits right along a very important political divide. You know, I think people want to believe that when they go to a McDonald's and order a Big Mac and a 32-ounce soft drink, they're doing that because of their own choices. And everyone likes the idea of giving people those choices. At the same time, people don't actually want to get fat and may have some recognition that the very liberties that they enjoy when they go to McDonald's sometimes don't lead to the very choices that they would rather have made, you know, with a longer-term perspective.
Are you saying that we are being manipulated psychologically or that we are being manipulated biologically?
I guess I don't need to say that we're being manipulated. I think I would rather say that each of us as a human is very vulnerable. That is, we, for example, have a tendency to favor immediate gratification over long-term rewards. And I don't know that we need to be manipulated so much as we are unfortunately vulnerable to those things naturally.
So do you think it's possible to legislate healthy behavior? And if so, how?
Well, to be honest, you know, I think that there are often some psychological tricks that we can use to help people overcome their own foibles, the word that I've used here. And you know, some of them are purely financial. We can increase the taxation on certain products if we believe socially that they're undesirable. Certainly that's a plan that's been used and effectively used in the setting of tobacco. I imagine firms like McDonald's bristle at the idea of Big Macs being likened to cigarettes. But at the same time, if we have some social belief that a certain number of Big Macs is too many Big Macs, then perhaps strict financial policies could help us along that pathway. There are other tricks that people can use that involve sort of tricking themselves into not using products like this. But certainly there are alternatives to strict and heavy-handed legislation.
All right. Well, where do we draw the line? For example, in New York, Mayor Bloomberg wants to crack down on big gulp-sized sugary beverages in some venues, but not in all venues. As you say, tobacco regulation has had an impact. Alcohol regulation has had an impact. Do you cut back on the amount of advertising by these companies? Do you regulate what they put in their food? Where exactly is the line?
So I'm not a policymaker here, but if I were to think about this in the way that perhaps a firm does, you would say that it was a campaign, right? There is no single battle that defines the war here. I suspect that there are combinations of education, regulation, taxation, little tricks, coaching that people can have. Any number of ideas are going to be necessary. If there were a magic bullet, believe me, people would adopt it.
And what do you say to everybody listening who is thinking what we don't need is more nanny state regulation?
It's a loaded term if you say nanny state, but it is true that if you want more than 16 ounces of soda under Mayor Bloomberg's ideas, you might have to buy two of them or have a friend be a shill for you to get those things. I would say those are fairly soft levels of paternalism. That's hardly nanny state. That is, I think, a gentle nudge, an encouraging approach to help people get to the goals that they actually want for themselves but could use a little help.
Many parents were outraged when they saw the likes of Joe Camel pushing cigarettes on what looked to be young people. What do you think when you see a Ronald McDonald or a Burger King pushing hamburgers and French fries and milkshakes?
I would say that the cultural norms now are such that there is much wider recognition of the harms of tobacco than there is of the harms of Big Macs. On the other hand, it might not be too many more years until we get to a point where people think of McDonald's food and the way they think about tobacco. And with that, more tolerance for increasing regulation may follow.
Dr. David Ash is executive director of the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics and director of the Penn Medicine Center for Innovation. He's also a physician at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. Dr. Ash, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm guessing more than a few of you have something to say about where personal responsibility ends and government intervention begins. Bring it on. Go to marketplace.org. Let us know what you think. And we finally reached the part of the show. Well, it's the whole reason I agreed to sit in for Test this week. It's where I get to talk to you about your personal finance issues, the ones you care about most. And I'm not going to keep this all to myself, so I've asked my friend, financial expert Jill Schlesinger, to join us. She's editor-at-large for CBSMoneyWatch.com. Hiya, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Hey, it's back to school season. A lot of families now are trying to think how to get their finances straight now that they're going to be thinking more about education, school supplies, clothing, and whatnot. Are there any tips that people should keep in mind?
You know, when I was a financial advisor, I used to love back to school because I would say, all right, now everyone's got that summer brain freeze. It's all over. We can get back into our game plan here. And of course, what we used to always say is, you know, like you want a game plan for your kids in school. How about a game plan for your family? And you know, it is so horrible to bang this drum, but I'm going to do it. Yes, you need a game plan. Yes, you need a financial plan. It doesn't have to be a 100-page Harvard Business School study, but it does have to be something that you, some document that you create as a family, and you say, here's what we're trying to accomplish. And it can be, we want to increase our retirement contributions by a couple of percent. We want to open 529 plans for the kids. And it could even be really old school back to basics. We're going to start tracking how much money we spend just to get an idea of how to plan for the future. Any one of those things would be a great first task to start when you're beginning your financial planning.
And here's the education question that's been gnawing at me. Number two pencils. Whatever happened to the number one pencil?
Yeah, you know what? The number one failed miserably. I don't know if you know this. It was I don't know what happened to it.
That was a great bluff, though. I'm really impressed. All right. Well, let's move past the bluffs and get right back into what we are talking about here, and that is bringing the callers in. And our first caller is Megan Kohler of San Francisco, who's got wedding bells ringing in her future, but also she's got some issues. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So when's the big day?
November 3rd.
Oh, it's coming on like a freight train.
Yeah, I'm trying to look away.
Have you done all your planning?
The big things are out of the way, so I feel like we're smooth sailing from here, hopefully.
Do you have Jennifer Lopez planning your thing? I saw the movie.
Definitely not.
Okay, so let's talk about what happens when, let's call it a merger. You're gonna be marrying your beloved, and your finances will be affected. How do you see your finances playing out?
Well, we're trying to figure that out. We're both coming from sort of different angles at this point. I'd like to think I've developed a bit of financial literacy over the last couple of years and have carried no debt and, you know, put 10% towards my 401k and max out my Roth IRA. I have a little taxable investment account, sort of my someday fund on the side. My fiancé, on the other hand, is coming from a slightly more complicated financial background. He's been running his own business, which he's pretty much regarded as his retirement vehicle, and has taken on a bit of debt. So thankfully, we are now in a position where he is selling his interest in his business and has a good tech industry job at the moment.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, hang on, though. What is his business that he's selling off?
I don't know if I am at liberty to say.
Ooh, is it naughty or what? You can tell us.
Sure. It's it's basically a national regulating body for a drinking game.
I'm sorry. Let's go. Let's roll the videotape right back. Say that again. It's a what?
It's the national regulating body for a popular college drinking game.
What game?
Beer pong.
I mean, this is fabulous.
Wait a minute. It's beer pong?
Yes.
And this is the regulating body?
Yes, it's the National Beer Pong League, in fact.
I didn't even know there were rules, to be honest.
Yeah, well, they've created them and they regulate them.
Can you make money doing that?
You can, thankfully.
And you say he's got a tech job lined up. Is this a good, honest, solid tech job with a big, honest, solid company?
Yes. It's a small startup still, but it's a solid job that's pretty far into funding.
All right, so Jill Schlesinger, I've heard risk and risk here.
Yes.
Yeah. This is, but I'm so grateful that Megan is actually marrying this man, because obviously she is going to take him on the path of financial security.
Wait a minute. We all know that women should not be trying to change their men.
No, but I think this one she may. So I'm wondering, just because it is a small startup, when he goes off and has he started that job already or
yes.
not?
Yes, he's been doing that for several months now.
So I'm guessing maybe there may not be full huge benefits at this organization?
Correct. They do not have access to 401k, but they do have decent salaries, thankfully.
So, Jill, do you like pooling the funds or keeping the account separate?
Well, I am completely unromantic. I like to do whatever works for a couple. I mean, and frankly, number one, I would say, is that, you know, because he has debt that's out there and you don't, it always feels a little unequal. And so what I would say is his number one task as he sells the business is to get that debt paid off as soon as possible. Does he have any other debt besides the business debt? Is there credit card debt sneaking around somewhere?
There's a bit of credit card debt and a personal friend loan and student loans.
And along these lines, I am guessing, Megan, that your credit score is higher than your betrothed.
Yes.
And right now you guys rent.
Correct.
Okay. So I think that this is actually a case where you absolutely don't want to marry your credit at all right now. And the way that, you know, the only reason that you marry your credit is if you need your income to qualify for something, for example, a house. Mm-hmm. But in your case, what I would say is you probably are not in the position to be buying a house just yet. I mean, I think it's great that you've got your someday fund in that investment pool, which is probably what you're thinking is like a down payment account. Mm-hmm. But, you know, until he gets secure, meaning pays off all of his debt, gets his job secure, and you guys are on a path where you're really a little bit more stable than you are right now, I would say I would not actually recommend that you buy a house. If you take all of his debt, meaning the business, the credit card, the personal, the student loan, what kind of number are we talking about?
I do not know the exact figure now, but I think we're looking at about $20,000.
Okay, this is not wait. That's
manageable.
Actually not terrible.
Yeah,
manageable.
That's totally manageable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but I would say that, you know, you guys need to have the talk. Yep. The talk is not about sex in your case. It is about money. And the talk is tough to have, but you've got to do it. And there's not an easy way to do it. I mean, if you're going to get married, you're going to find out that, you know, look, this is the deal. We love each other. We want to be with each other. It doesn't mean that you've got to marry your finances 100% the day you say I do. What it does mean is that I think it's fair to say that at this point, he's got a lot of work to do paying down his debt and getting that cranked away, and he'll do that. I mean, again, like you said, he's got a good job now, so he can do that, and that should be his priority. In the meantime, you should continue to save just as you are doing, and I would not combine anything. I would not have a joint credit card, which is a horrible thing to do. I wouldn't apply for an auto loan together. You don't need to do that, and I would pull back and wait on the house until he's got that debt really under control, probably everything except the student loan, you know, and I don't think that that's going to be a long time for you guys, but I think it's something he should do. And because he doesn't have a 401k plan, unfortunately, you know, he's going to just do a boring old IRA. He doesn't have a 401k. He's going to have an IRA, and he's going to be limited to that, you know, just the $5,000, and that's going to be it for now. But you know what? He's got bigger fish to fry anyway. He's got to pay down the debt first. So it's not such a terrible thing that he doesn't have the 401k right out of the gate.
And Megan, he's very lucky he's got somebody who's fiscally prudent like you around. I hope you're feeling a little more empowered now.
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, well, thank you for calling in, and mazel tov in advance.
Thank you.
Also, I got to say, best drinking game of all time, Hi Bob. When you watch the Bob Newhart show, every time somebody says Hi Bob, you got a drink.
Wow, there you go.
Killer game.
Uh-huh.
All right, thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
A few weeks ago, we advised a caller to never, ever, ever carry your Social Security card around in your wallet. And that's for all kinds of obvious reasons, of course. And you're talking to a guy here who's had his identity stolen 3 times. But listener Norman Moody from Hackensack, Minnesota, may have found a flaw in our advice. Norman, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So I'm guessing that you don't deliberately carry your Social Security number around in your wallet.
No, in fact, I'm very careful not to carry it around in my wallet. But it was an interesting coincidence that the segment, Why Scammers Like Seniors, came on, and the next day, my Medicare card came, and on the back it says, carry this card with you when you're away from home, and there sits my Social Security number.
Seriously, right there on the back of the card?
Right on the back of the card.
In all its glory?
Yes. On the front of the card, your Medicare claim number is your Social Security number.
Yeah, and if I may interject here, I'll tell you something. My dad pointed this out to me, actually, because he had his identity stolen, and he said to me, you know, how could I, it might be someone in a medical office. And I said, well, that's terrible. What are you saying that for? And he pointed out the exact same thing. So I did a little digging into this when I found this out, and I talked to someone in the Social Security Administration who said, basically, off the record, we totally know this is a terrible thing, but we don't want to have a whole new series of ID cards printed up. So it's on the to-do list when we have more funding.
But Jill, there's something even more egregious here, and that is there are a number of government agencies that don't just put this information on the letter or the card. They actually put it on the outside of the envelope.
Oh!
I have seen it.
God,
I have readers send me envelopes that actually have either the Social Security number visible through the little window or actually printed somewhere on the envelope. You've got to wonder what these guys are thinking.
Not a lot.
Let me ask you, Norman, how diligent are you in protecting your identity? What steps do you take?
Very diligent. I carry the Social Security card, but I have blacked out the number. I keep that at home.
Well, let me tell you this. Don't carry the card at all, even
right,
if you black it out, because there are ways to scrub the ink or hold it up to a light or do things like that. And never put it past a scammer to have a way around your defensive measures.
Very good.
These people are very bright about it. You do want to memorize it. And if you're having kind of issues with your memory, you know, just between you and me and the millions of other people listening, you can always write it on the inside of your shoe. I'm serious. That's also a good place to put your gym locker combination. It just, you know, anything that's outside of your wallet is just that much safer. But you definitely do not want anything that even looks like a Social Security card in your wallet at any time.
Great.
And I hope you are never a victim of this sort of thing.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Norman. And Jill, I got to say to you, I mean, I had my identity stolen several times. And
what kind of person has his identity stolen three times? I just want to ask this.
Listen,
like, well,
girlfriend,
how does this
happen? Is a reason this is the fastest growing white collar crime in the United States. 10 million people victimized by this every single year. And the reason is because no matter what kind of steps you take, and hey, look, I'm a consumer advocate. I'm a guy who takes steps. It can still happen.
Sometimes I think people get a bit lazy when they're doing online banking and they're doing online purchasing and they're doing a few things here and there. And you know what? You really have to be vigilant and you really have to be careful. And you have to be careful what your kids are doing and who your kids are giving information out to. That is the biggest area of identity theft that's growing, is in younger people.
Absolutely. And remember, if you don't keep watch on your finances and on your identity, nobody will. All right. Well, a lot of people have been hearing that the clouds are starting to move away and the sun is starting to come through as far as the economy goes. And we've turned a corner, two chickens in every pot. You know the story. But I think for a lot of people still working their way through the Great Recession, times are still relatively tough. And one of those people is Bill Hildebrand of Sunnyvale, California. Bill joins us now. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So tell us what's going on in your life.
When we total up our living expenses, basic things like housing and health care, service on debt, and send out all those bills, we don't really have anything left over to save for retirement or for college.
So basically, you're meeting all of your expenses with your income, and then all that other stuff, college plus retirement for two?
That's right, and we're in our 50s, so it's coming pretty soon.
And you're wondering how you're going to do this.
Right. And, you know, business has been picking up a little bit, but we're working a lot. We're just not making that much.
Bill, first of all, I got to say, you are not alone in the anxiety you're feeling here. I know a lot of families, my own included, that's dealing with a lot of these same pressures. Let me ask you now, are you economizing as best you can?
We've been cutting back in all the sensible ways. So there isn't a big pool of money there that we can easily draw from.
And I was just wondering, you said the living expenses plus service on debt. Did you accrue some debt during the lean times, like some credit card or auto loans? Is there something going on that side of it beyond a mortgage?
Yes, that's exactly what happened. So just to keep the businesses afloat, we plowed through our savings and ran up some credit card debt and debt with, you know, business vendors, just to keep the doors open. We've been paying it back, but we got a ways to go still.
Mm-hmm. Yep. When you are self-employed, you'll never make this mistake again, I promise you. But when you are self-employed, the lesson that we all learn at some point is we need much bigger emergency reserve funds than other people who have real jobs. I always say real jobs because, you know, there are people out there who work and they don't worry about their jobs 24/7 like you do. And the joy of owning your own business also means that as you start saving again, the best thing you can do, Bill, is to have a year of your living expenses in the bank.
And I got another thing to look at, too, and that is, you know, as a dad, Bill, you're probably thinking, I'm the breadwinner, it's my job to provide. But remember, your family is a team. And while you would love to be able to say, I'm going to set aside everything my kids are going to need for their higher education, well, it could be that your kids, as I did, will end up working their way through school to some extent. It could be that they will rely on financial aid more so than you had planned. There are ways that this whole thing can be worked out. Now, yes, indeed, that will saddle your kids with debt. But if the choice is nobody goes to school and nobody retires, or these two kids go to school and my wife and I do retire, it's the latter plan you want to try and target. And if that means that the kids are going to be pitching in a little bit too, well, so be it.
Yeah, I worked myself through school too. And so, and I think they've kind of figured that much out already.
Yeah, and I would take that off the list of the to-do list for you guys. School is so far below everything else that needs to happen right now. Your big list is debt pay down, emergency reserve fund, start putting money into retirement. Those are your three goals. That's it. There should be nothing else on your list.
That's a game plan. Bill, does that work for you?
I think so.
All right. Best of luck.
Good luck.
All right. My thanks to Jill Schlesinger from CBS Money Watch. Thank you so much for joining me, Jill.
It was great to be with you. What a lot of fun.
Yes, indeed. We should do this more often when Tess isn't around.
Oh, I know. It's like cheating on your sister or something. Fabulous.
All right. You got questions, conundrums, financial confusion? Boy, are you in the right place. We are here to help. And you can find us on Facebook. You can tweet at us. You can even drop us a line at marketplace.org. Talking about the intersection of politics and personal finance this week. And here's an issue that's gotten voters bacon sizzling over the last year: student loans. Believe it or not, there's already more student debt outstanding than there are credit card bills. And this is the one type of debt you can't chase away with a bankruptcy filing. Meanwhile, tuition costs keep rising with no end in sight. Commentator Andrew Kelly says it's time for states to rethink their relationship with public education and perhaps pass on a greater share of the costs to families.
In earlier eras, the government had good reason to invest public funds in higher education to make it more readily available. For most of this nation's history, access to higher education was limited. That's because post-secondary learning was only available at a small number of physical campuses with highly educated professors, massive collections of books, and specialized facilities. College was a scarcity. Students who wished to pursue higher education had to travel to these campuses to learn. Those in rural areas often lacked access, as well as those in more populous places, where demand outstripped the supply of seats in the lecture hall. This is where the state came in. To make higher education more widely available, the state built hundreds of regional four-year campuses, followed by more than 1,000 community colleges. To keep college affordable, the state has subsidized public institutions directly and provided indirect subsidies to all institutions via student aid. This heavily subsidized model made sense, so long as higher education was a scarce commodity. But advances in technology, like digital content and online delivery, have made higher education available to a much wider audience, creating models of college that are far less expensive to provide. For the most part, traditional institutions of higher education have not embraced these innovations, continuing to operate as they did 50 years ago. Still, they expect the levels of public subsidy they grew accustomed to in the era of scarcity. But the world has changed, and higher education policy must change with it. The state still has an interest in creating a highly educated workforce, but technology provides us with far more cost-effective means of doing so. Rather than plead for more money to subsidize an increasingly outdated model, colleges and universities must embrace the innovations that can make them more cost-effective. If they do not, a slew of new providers, who receive no public subsidy at all, will be there to pick up the slack.
Andrew Kelly is a research fellow in education policy at the American Enterprise Institute. I don't mind saying I disagree pretty strongly with Mr. Kelly's position in that commentary. Call me a running dog socialist, but I think it's the responsibility of the government to ensure that everyone has access to a decent education. All right, some of you might agree with me on this, some of you, not so much. That's cool. Let's talk about it. To go deeper on this issue, I've asked Neil McCluskey to join me. He's Associate Director of the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom. Mr. McCluskey, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what obligation does the public sector have to provide an education, and more to the point, a higher education, to people?
Well, I'd say the public sector actually has no obligation to provide higher education. Now, of course, this is speaking not in the world we're in right now, obviously. States all have flagship public colleges and universities. They have community colleges. The federal government provides lots of money to students to pay for tuition. But this has led to lots of very painful problems. And I think that when we look at that in its totality, you would say that the public sector really shouldn't be involved in higher education.
But if we leave it just to private institutions, that would make a higher education even less accessible to folks.
Well, see, and I don't think that that's actually accurate. So the first thing we have to say is let's deal with the big problem. The big problem right now is the price of college is extremely high. There is very strong evidence that the reason it is so high is because the federal government in particular provides lots of people lots of money to pay for college. What do the schools do? They raise their prices and capture that money. So get rid of that, And there's a very good chance the schools would lower their prices so it'd be just as accessible without taking lots of taxpayer money. Then the other thing is, if you don't have states collecting taxes that they then send to public colleges and universities, that money stays with those people. They could use that for higher education, but they could also use it for other things that it turns out might be of more value to them than paying for a public college or university.
But I wonder if supply and demand actually backs up your argument, because if, as you say, if you take some of that funding away, prices will go down. Well, if there is still a steady pool of people with the means and with the willingness to pay the higher prices, then that's going to simply keep the prices up and close the door on others.
Yeah, but the reality is it doesn't seem most people do have the means to pay this. The way they pay it is they either get grants from the federal government or they get subsidized loans from the federal government. Most people aren't paying the price of college themselves. And then you add to the fact that public college and universities, where about 80% of people go, have massive subsidies up front, and almost nobody is actually paying the cost of their own education.
All right. Well, if that's the case, then where do we draw the line? Should the government get out of the building bridges business or the building roads business?
What I can tell you about, because this is what I study, is higher education. And I can tell you from looking at the evidence in higher education, it is very clear that the effect of government intervention in higher education has been on net negative. And in fact, there have been studies that have looked, and they're not perfect. Now, these are not conclusive, but they've tried to control for lots of variables that influence state-level economic growth. The more states tend to spend on higher education, the lower their rates of economic growth. And that suggests that spending on higher ed by government is very inefficient, less efficient than what people would have used their money for if they could keep it.
And yet, at the same time, there have been studies that show that there is a correlation between one's education level and one's income level. And obviously, the higher an income level you have, the more you are paying taxes into society, the more you are generating revenue for society. It would seem to be a good investment to try to ensure that all people in a state or countrywide have as much of an education as they can possibly get their hands on.
Well, and see, this is, it seems very paradoxical, because it's absolutely true that the correlation is the more education you have, the better income you have, the better income safety you have, and that you're less likely to become unemployed. But just as it's very important that we all have food, we all need lots of food. Generally, the people who can access more food and better food are better off. But you can also overeat. You can overeat to the point of obesity. And that's what we're seeing in higher education. We're seeing people having to pay way too much for way too little education that's of value, and way too many people paying for things that they ultimately either aren't motivated enough to finish or unable to finish. So yes, education is important, but we have way overspent on education.
Neil McCluskey is Associate Director of the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom, and he's author of the book Feds in the Classroom: How Big Government Corrupts, Cripples, and Compromises American Education. Neil, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Mr. McCluskey and I spoke for more than just 5 minutes. Needless to say, there's a lot to be said on this topic. You can find a longer version of our conversation online at marketplace.org. And as usual, I want to hear what you have to say on this and all the other things we've been talking about. So bring it on. That's Marketplace Money for this week. We're continuing all these conversations online at marketplace.org. Join us there or on our Facebook page. Next time, it's a dirty job, but someone has to do it.
Man, I was out on some rigs that were like, you know, you get helicoptered out an hour out. It's like me and 100 guys. Oh, I got asked a lot, like, what you doing out here, little girl?
Women fight for equal pay in Louisiana. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Joel Patterson, and Bridget Bodner. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. Tess Viglin is back next week. Until then, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.